Science can't explain everything. Just because you can't see me doesn't mean I'm not here.
Thank you for joining me, everyone, and welcome to Paranormal Encounters podcast series. My name is Dr. Kelly Renee Schutz. I am the host and the producer of this show. Sit back, grab yourself some popcorn, and let's get started.
Be careful what you wish for.
Yes, indeed. Let's get started. Tonight we are interviewing Reverend Dr. Victor Furman. He is a healer, a spiritual counselor, and author whose deep and rich voice inspired the radio handle Victor the Voice. He has a soulful sound which helps people heal, and he is the host and producer of Destination Unlimited podcast. He graduated from the New Seminary in 1997, receiving his doctorate in 2020. He was a former Armed Forces broadcast journalist, a storyteller by nature, and he is an inspiring public speaker. He brings unconditional love, compassion, and a great sense of humor to the ministry. He is best known to his audiences with paranormal investigation teams, where he specializes in sending earthbound spirits into the light. He has been featured on A&E's Unexplained and Bravo's Pregnant in Heels. He is not only on this program tonight, but he is on my television show, Disembodied Voices, where you can actually see him in person. That one is slated to begin on June 19th at 8 o'clock p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And he will also be heard on the Para-X Radio Network come sometime in September. Yes, indeed, Dr. Furman, you're going to be heard all over the place. So without further ado, we need to get started. Please welcome my guest, Dr. Victor Furman.
Whether you're listening at home, at work, or anywhere, thanks for making Para-X part of your day. Your source for everything paranormal, Para-X.
Well, thank you, Victor, for being on the show today. We are very excited to have you aboard. Welcome aboard.
Thank you so much, Kelly. I'm used to being on the other side of the microphone, so thank you.
No problem. Well, as I always start my interviews out, I always like to get into humble beginnings, because once you build that foundation with people, then they kind of understand a little bit more about where you're going and how you arrived at where you're at right now. So why don't we just start with the basics and tell us a little bit about where all this began for you.
My story begins in 1953 in Brooklyn, New York. I was born to an interfaith couple because my mother had been Catholic. My father had been Jewish. They got married. She converted to Judaism after they were married. And we were really raised in a culturally Jewish home, not so much a religious Jewish home. But interestingly enough, and I didn't find this out until later in life when I attended interfaith seminary in the 1990s, my mother confessed to me that when I was 8 weeks old, she took me to her aunt's house here in New York, and her aunt was Catholic, and her aunt said to my mother, "You look tired. Why don't you take a nap, and we'll look after Victor for you?" And unbeknownst to my mother, they took me to a church, and they baptized me. So in the first 8 weeks of my life, I was snipped and dipped. But that actually set the pace for the rest of my life, because I've had a sense of that interfaith connection almost all of my life. As I said, I was growing up in Brooklyn. I had a lot of unusual experiences as a child, which we'll get into a little bit later in the interview. My dad took ill when I was eight. Unfortunately, he developed diabetes, lost a leg, had a series of strokes. And prior to his getting sick, I really never felt, and it's strange to say, but I really never felt loved by him. He was almost 20 years older than my mother when they got married. And I had the sense that And I was the firstborn, and perhaps maybe sort of a disappointment, the fact that a child had come in. But, you know, this is the way I interpreted based upon his reaction to me and so on. And when he got sick, I became part of his caretaking team with my mother. And for the first time, I truly felt loved by him. And it wired in my young mind this concept that if you care for others, you will be loved. And that set a stage for a great deal of my life, to the extent that I often neglected myself for the good of others. And we'll talk about that also a little bit later, and having to be able to set healthy and safe boundaries, and also learning that love starts within, not without. And so we'll talk about that a little bit more later. In any event, I was very good in science in school. I was very good in writing in school, and have been doing poetry since I was a child. In fact, when I was a kid, I thought I was the reincarnation of Edgar Allan Poe, because a lot of my poems were very poesque, were very macabre and down and dark. And so I had a feeling at one point that I may have been the reincarnation of Edgar Allan Poe, but later in life I realized I had not been. Went to high school. Again, science and also history and mathematics, and then went to college. And then in the first and a half year of my college, I won the only lottery that I've ever won in my entire life, and that was the draft lottery. And a lot of my friends did the runaway to Canada, and a lot of my friends protested the draft. And a friend of mine said, you know something, you're not the kind of person who runs. You are the kind of person who applies themselves and does something. And he said, you know, the Air Force is a wonderful place to go. He said, why don't you go visit an Air Force recruiter? So I went to an Air Force recruiter, and I said, you know, I'm really interested in science, and I'm contemplating medicine. Will the Air Force make me a doctor? And he said, yes, son, sign on the dotted line. The Air Force will make you a doctor. And I was naive, and little did I know that that would not happen. In any event, wound up down in San Antonio, Texas, at Lackland Air Force Base for basic training. The first day we were there, there were 50 of us. We were given an exam. The next day, five of us were called into a room and given a choice, because we had scored the highest on the tests. And they gave us a choice of five different opportunities. One was to go to what they call crypto school, which basically meant that you ended up in a bunker somewhere ready to launch missiles. The other one was to go out to the Presidio in Monterey, California, and learn the Russian language. And we said, what happens after that? You go to a mountaintop in Turkey and you intercept signals. So all of these things were not really appealing to me. I wound up in a thing called the Air Force Logistics System, which is basically computers, and wound up at Andrews Air Force Base as my first duty assignment in Washington, D.C., working on the logistics system there. Not very happy about it, but was doing my job. And during the course of that year, I saw a thing in the base newspaper said the Air Force needs broadcasters. And having had a background in college radio and my voice, I decided I would try out for that. And I wound up at Fort Benjamin Harrison in Indianapolis, Indiana. And I spent 6 weeks at the Defense Information School and learned the military broadcasting and newspaper writing and article writing and so on. And that next January, I was stationed in Korea, Seoul, Korea, with the American Forces Korea Network. And it was a lot of fun, actually. I really enjoyed being over there. A couple of interesting things happened when I was in Korea. The first thing is, one morning I heard a voice. Now, throughout my life, I've heard voices giving me information. And I learned that I could either let the information go, just let it go offhand. I could say something like, that's interesting, but not for right now. Or I could say, yes, I have to act on that, act upon that immediately. And one morning I heard the word saying, mom is sick. You have to call her. Now, I had no indication, no letter from her, no sharing of any kind that anything was wrong. And I called her, and it was evening in New York, morning in Korea. And I called, and she picked up the phone. My sister picked up the extension phone simultaneously. And I said, mom, what's wrong? And my sister said, oh my God, how did he find out? And it turned out she was scheduled for extensive surgery the next day. But I had this immediate sense that she was going to be fine. She'd have a full recovery and she would be fine. And she in fact was. And she was grateful that I made that phone call. So that was the first thing that happened of interest while I was over there. The second thing was I had some issues with my back. And in those days, they had acupuncture available in Korea, and I had never had acupuncture before. Mm-hmm. What I was unaware of was that, number one, the needles weren't exactly disposable or sterilized properly. Okay. And number two, that hepatitis B mm-hmm. was endemic in Korea, which means many people were carriers of hepatitis B. Mm-hmm. I had my acupuncture. My back did feel a little bit better. A couple of weeks later, I woke up one morning and I looked in the mirror and my eyes were starting to turn yellow. I also had lost my appetite, and I said, oh, something's wrong here. Mm-hmm. I went down to the hospital, which was actually the descendant of the 4077th MASH hospital, for those who used mm-hmm. to love to watch MASH, but there was an actual hospital, not a field hospital. Mm-hmm. And the doctor looked at me and says, you have hepatitis. And they immediately admitted me. I spent about 2 weeks there, and I was getting sicker and sicker and losing weight. They were treating me differently than the other hepatitis patients, giving me shots of vitamin K and other things. And one day the doctor came and said, do you have a will, son? And I said, no, I don't have a will. And they said, well, we're going to send over the JAG to have you do a will. You need a will. I said, why? He says, you're not doing well, and we want you to have a will in place in case the worst happens. Hmm. They also sent a telegram back to my mother through the Red Cross here in New York, basically saying that I was very, very seriously ill, and the prognosis of my recovery was not great, which thrilled my mother, of course. Yeah. In any event, a couple of days later, I had a voice in my head saying, ask the doctor for an anatomy book with a picture of a healthy liver. Okay. I said, okay. I said to the doctor, I said, doctor, can I have a picture or the book that shows a picture of a healthy liver? He said, why?
Yeah.
I said, it wouldn't hurt. He said, okay. He brought me the book. I started studying the picture. Mm-hmm. At some point, I put the book down and the voice said, place your hands over your abdomen. And I did. Mm-hmm. And I started feeling immediately this tingling sensation, this beautiful tingling and warmth permeating my entire abdomen. Mm-hmm. And this went on for a period of time, I'm not sure how long, and I fell asleep. Mm-hmm. The next morning at 5 a.m., the nurse came in and apologized for waking me because they drew the blood at 5 a.m., mm-hmm. took my blood samples. 2 hours later, she came back and she said, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to stick you again. The lab messed up your bloods. I said, okay. Mm-hmm. Hour later, the doctor came in and said, what did you do last night after I gave you the book? Mm-hmm. And I told him, he says, you're crazy. Mm-hmm. And I said, why? And he said, because last night we didn't think you'd survive the night. This morning, your liver enzymes are practically normal. Mm. Everything is practically normal. And we've never seen anything like that ever happen before.
Hmm. Interesting.
You would think that I would have jumped up and said, Eureka, mm-hmm. miracle healing, this is my path.
Yeah.
But I wasn't ready. I wasn't ready. And basically just accepted the healing and went on with my life until I got out of the service. And we can talk more about that later.
Let me ask you a question here. So the voice in your head that you were hearing, what did that sound like to you? Because sometimes people refer to the voices that they hear in their heads as not their own. And did it sound female, male, your own intuitive voice? What did it sound like to you?
It sounded like my own voice. It sounded like
your
voice
own voice.
Talking to me, yeah.
That's interesting. So now you've had this experience. Your liver is basically healed. Would it be safe for me to say that you almost had a near-death experience?
Absolutely. Although I never lost consciousness, which often happens during NDEs.
Right. Yeah. That's what I was wondering about. So your conscious kind of near-death experience. So after that point, and did you get better and better? Where you were able to get back to your duties, or did they discharge you and send you home?
No, I was able to get back to my duties. And about 6 months later, they sent me for a liver scan, and my liver had completely healed as if I had never had the disease.
Hmm. I've heard of this before, but I've never met anyone who's gone through this before. And I would assume that you probably felt a lot better too, huh?
Absolutely. And interestingly enough, later on, after I was out of the service back here in New York, at some point they were asking for volunteers who had hepatitis to donate blood to make vaccine. And when I went to the blood center here in New York to donate my blood. They take a sample. Mm-hmm. And the doctor called me a couple of days later and said, we can't use your blood. There's no evidence that you ever had the disease.
Okay, so now we've had this experience. And would you say that you've had paranormal experiences throughout your life? And can you recall your first one?
Absolutely. Okay. When I was 7 years old, I was very close with my paternal grandfather, my father's father. He was in his late 80s, early 90s when I was a child, because my father, as I mentioned earlier, was significantly older than my mother.
Yeah.
And he would talk to me, not as a child, but as someone who would understand higher meanings and things. He mm-hmm. was a very, very, very contemplative man, and mm-hmm. saw things that others did not see. In any event, I'm about 7 years old, and I'm in my bedroom, mm-hmm. and I'm reading something, and I look up, and my grandfather's standing there. I said, Grandpa, when did you come in?
Yeah.
Didn't say a word, mm-hmm. didn't say a sound, just smiled, mm-hmm. and then disappeared, literally just vanished, dissolved, disappeared. I went into the living room, and I said, Mom, Dad, Grandpa was just here. And they said, oh, you're imagining things, because I was labeled a child with an overactive imagination for other reasons, which I'll share with you in a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And about a few minutes later, the phone rang with word that my grandfather had passed away. So yeah. That was my first conscious experience of disembodied spirit, of the fact that when the body stops, the essence of who we are, that energy, some people call it the soul, whatever the word is,
that
goes on. And we can talk more about that later also. Mm-hmm. But that was my first. Now, interestingly enough, and this is something that I had confirmed later in life, the very next day, I had a conscious UFO contact experience.
Hmm. At the age of seven.
At the age of seven. And my first conscious, it was at the age of five. Let's backtrack for a second. So the age of five was my first conscious experience.
Yeah.
And what happened was I had this sensation that I was being lifted in the air.
Hmm.
And not afraid at all. I had no fear whatsoever in the situation.
Mm-hmm.
And these people, these beings, whatever you want to call them, that I met, I called my teachers because they taught me things mm-hmm. that I had no other source for. When my parents would talk about my strange experiences, they'd say I was imagining things. I said, no, I was going to night school.
Mm-hmm.
They said, what do you mean night school? I said, because I learned things mm-hmm. that I didn't learn in regular school. I learned things that I didn't have any type of an education for. Mm-hmm. And at 5 and 6 years old, when most of my contemporaries, boys, were looking for toy trucks yeah. or soldiers mm-hmm. or things of that nature, mm-hmm. I wanted electronic parts to build radios. I wanted crystal to build a crystal radio and a cat's whisker. And I built my first crystal radio at age 6.
Okay.
My first transistor radio, actually no, first tube radio at age 8, and then transistor radio, I think, was 11. Mm-hmm. That's what I wanted to do. I wanted to play with electronics. I didn't want to. Where did that come from? That was not part of my family. That was not part of my upbringing, not part of my formal education. So where did that come from? So that was the earliest experience, like I said, that I remember was 5, but there were actually earlier experiences.
Did you say that you actually visually saw these teeth? Okay. Describe for us what they looked like.
In my mind's eye, what I saw mm-hmm. were basically tall, very tall,
mm-hmm.
Human-like, humanoid beings.
Okay.
I'd say the skin was a bluish gray color.
Okay.
And very large eyes.
Very large eyes.
But not frightening at all. Nothing to be afraid of. I remember them as being very friendly and very gentle.
Hmm.
And almost, like I said, almost loving paternal teachers.
Mm-hmm. In your room?
Initially in my room. Well, actually, as I was floating up, yes.
Oh, that, okay. So now you're floating up. Did you say you went through the roof of your house?
I actually don't remember that part of it. I remember just floating.
Mm-hmm.
And the next thing I knew, I was in this craft.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about this craft. Now, you're 5, right?
I'm when 5 you're having years old, this, correct.
Now you're in this craft. What did this craft look like? And what do you recall experiencing there?
I remember it looking like a very, very interesting classroom.
Mm-hmm.
I remember what I eventually realized were actually windows, thinking they were screens of projections of the stars
mm-hmm.
and the planets.
Mm-hmm.
I remember sitting in a special chair. I don't know what it was. I just knew it was a special chair.
Mm-hmm.
And that through the context of that chair, information was given to me. And also there was no speech. There was no verbal communication. It was all done telepathically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Interesting. No fear. curious? Did
curiosity,
you say
absolutely, absolute curiosity. I was a very curious kid. I always wanted to find things out. But as I said, I had a sense that these were my teachers, and I also had a sense that I'd known them before.
Right. How long did you stay there?
I was back in my room the next morning, so I assume it was overnight at that point. And then I had a series of those. There were like three or four of those that happened after that. Mm-hmm. But what's really interesting is when I would tell my mother that I went to night school, my father, they'd say, "You have an overactive imagination." Mm-hmm. When I was 6 years old in first grade, the teacher had a book on the classroom shelf called "You Will Go to the Moon." This would have been 1959. Mm-hmm. I said to the teacher, "Can I borrow that book and read it?" And she said, "Of course." Mm-hmm. I took the book home. 2 weeks later, she said, "You know, you really have to bring that book back. It's for other children to read." I said, "I'm not bringing it back." She said, "Why?" I said, "Because it's wrong." Mm. She goes, "Wrong? What do you mean?" I said, "It's wrong. I've been there. It's wrong." Needless to say, a counselor was called. My parents were called. Mm-hmm. Went through this whole process of trying to explain and, you know, again, chalked off to an overactive imagination. Mm-hmm. I just want to sort of encapsulate and close the story. So my mom unfortunately passed away in January of 2020. Oh. I used to visit her. She was in a nursing home. She had gotten Parkinson's disease 3 or 4 years before that. And I would go there frequently on a Saturday or Sunday and take her out to lunch or bring lunch to her if she couldn't go out. Mm-hmm. And at one of these lunches, she said, "Why do I have Parkinson's disease? No one in our family ever had Parkinson's disease." Mm-hmm. And I said, "Mom, you never believed me when I was a kid and told you about all the wacky things that were going on. Mm-hmm. But there are some who say that families who have had extraterrestrial contact often experience genetic changes. Hmm. And those might manifest in unusual diseases." Mm-hmm. I said, "You got to realize that my younger brother and sister and I have three different autoimmune conditions, nothing life-threatening, but three different autoimmune conditions." And I said, "And you have the Parkinson's disease." I said, "But you don't remember having any strange experiences, did you? You always used to tell me it was my imagination. Did you anything strange ever happen to you?" And she said, "No. Except for that time," and the hair on the back of my neck starts standing up because I know what's coming. "You were about a year old," which would have been January, February of 1954. Mm-hmm. She said, "It was about 3 o'clock in the morning. Mm-hmm. I woke up and heard you crying. Mm-hmm. I went into the kitchen to prepare a bottle for you. Mm-hmm. And the strange light came through the window. And that's the last thing I remember until the next day." Hmm. I said, "Thank you, Mom." I said, "You had to wait all these years to tell me."
Yeah.
I said, "Did you have any other strange experiences?" She said, "No, except for that time your father was having surgery." Yeah. "I was in the waiting room of the hospital, and all of a sudden, I was up on the ceiling looking down at myself, sitting in the chair waiting for your father."
Oh, that's interesting. And she's conscious doing that.
Body experience.
Oh, that's interesting. And what did she pass that off to be at that time, or didn't she really?
She never
really
said anything about it. So it was very interesting that she had to wait all those years.
Yeah.
But I'm grateful that she did share that with me before she transitioned. So
from her experiences to you, where do you think the connection is? Because obviously if she's had a few of these interesting experiences, how does that translate to you now being, I don't want to use the word the target, kind of an indirect target here of the next in line of the same family. What are your thoughts about that?
First of all, I never considered any of my experiences to be abductions. I felt that I went willingly and that, again, these were my teachers and they were teaching me things. And I had a familial sense about them, a real familial sense. That word is important, family, familial. Maybe, just maybe, and I haven't really looked into this beyond what we've been discussing, but there's familial connection. In other words, it wasn't just me and my mother, my brother, my sister, but others. Now, my brother and sister have no conscious memories of any of this, but perhaps other members of the family who predeceased me or predeceased us had experiences like that. The other thing that's been happening more and more is I'm connecting with people as I'm doing my podcasts who, by the time the podcasts are over, I recognize having traveled with them before, whether this was as soul family, kindred spirit, soul family, or something else. Again, that word family comes up. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, a few weeks back, I did an interview with Preston Dennett and a wonderful woman by the name of Dolly Safran. Mm-hmm. And his book is about her experiences, mm-hmm. her multiple experiences mm-hmm. going on till today with contact. And when I looked at her face, I said, if she had brown eyes instead of blue eyes, mm-hmm. she could be my sister. Mm-hmm. And then strangely enough, I saw pictures of her father on Facebook. Mm-hmm. And her father and I, if you took 20 years and added to me, mm-hmm. made me a little chunkier. And I used to be heavier. I lost a lot of weight. Mm-hmm. I could be his twin, except for the blue eyes.
That's a little spooky when you think about it. The people that contact you when you're on your podcast, what is the trigger point that all of a sudden you kind of have that aha moment where you think that maybe this isn't necessarily a coincidence, but it's a little bit more than a coincidence. There's got to be an aha point for everybody that you chat with. What is it for you?
It's in the process of asking questions and hearing the answers and the conversation that ensues. And I know I've had that conversation before.
Oh, that's interesting.
Auditory, for sure. Absolutely auditory. Auditory is very big for me. Clairaudience is a major part of what I experience. So when I hear them share, I say, you know, we've had this conversation before. Sometimes there's a physical recognition, but more than likely, it's the auditory part of it. Yeah,
that's interesting. So now you've got these experiences going on, paranormal and, you know, extraterrestrial can be wrapped under the category of paranormal, but I'm in the process of trying to separate them just a little bit more. Have you ever had any paranormal experiences that really frightened you?
I can't say that. This is interesting. I'm a little different than most folks. Mm. I am not a person who is afraid in that sense. For whatever reason, I was born without that fight or flight reflex mm-hmm. in me. Mm-hmm. And I'd rather say if I was ever frightened of anything, it might have been of someone who might have meant violence to me, physical violence to me, mm-hmm. but not because of connection to spirit, not because of the ET experiences or the recent interviewee said as transdimensional. Called transdimensional beings. And that's something else that we can talk about a little later.
Yeah, no, I think this is a good place to put that in there. Why don't you explain that a little bit to our viewers and our listeners here? And because even myself, I'm now getting into trying to understand these various dimensions. So if you wouldn't mind, why don't we jump on in right here and have you explain it, maybe kind of give a description of what you're chatting about, and then maybe we can make a connection here.
Absolutely. I had the pleasure of interviewing Andrew mm-hmm. Collins. People will know Andrew Collins from Ancient Aliens and the Unexplained and all of his wonderful books. Mm-hmm. And he started out in 1975 investigating UFOs. He was a member of a UFO organization in Great Britain. Mm-hmm. And after a couple of years, he shares this when I interviewed him and in his new book, Origins of the Gods, mm-hmm. he started having a recognition that many of the people who shared their ET contact experiences or what they thought were ET contact experiences or UFO experiences also had a sense that they could use their minds to direct or make contact with the craft, with the UFOs mm-hmm. or the UAPs, whatever you'd like to call them. Mm-hmm. And that also that there was a sense that there was a psychic connection mm-hmm. between their mind and the experience that they were having, the UFO or the UAP or whatever the experience was that they were having. Mm-hmm. And as he went on through his studies and through his research, and then found out about quantum entanglement, which is part of physics, which basically says you can take two particles from the same atom or the same structure, the same material, separate them by thousands of miles, and whatever you do to one will affect the other. Mm. So what if this energy existed in another dimension?
Yeah.
Rather than space-time, but another dimension, an adjacent dimension or a parallel dimension. And what we're actually reacting with is this energy, this intelligent energy that resides in this other dimension rather than extraterrestrial. Now, he's saying he's not eliminating extraterrestrials or UFOs, but that perhaps these intelligences, these energy forms, are emulating these because they recognize the fact that we are looking for them.
Okay.
And you're probably familiar with what they call the CE5 contact modality.
I've heard of that.
Where people will go out and have a meditation and then ask for these craft or these UAPs or orbs, whatever you want to call them, to appear.
Yeah.
And they'll appear and seem to interact with the people who are sending out that message that they want to have the viewing. So this is what's called trans-dimensional contact. And he said that a great number of these contacts have to do with that. He further said that a great example of this is Skinwalker Ranch.
Mm.
And that at Skinwalker Ranch, those who are familiar with the program or have read the books about it, has that happening all the time, where people are looking for something and there's a reaction to that. And one of the other things he shares is that in most of these locations, which some people call portals, there is a geologic fault. And that geologic fault, there's a lot of crystals, such as quartz crystals and tourmaline and other elements that interact and create electromagnetic energy. And that electromagnetic energy can be used as a focal point for these portals.
You know, I don't like people giving orbs a bad rap all the time, saying that they think it's dust and moisture and this and that and whatever, because live in my house once and with my infrared camera, and after a while, you're going to understand that it's not always dust and moisture. Have you had people address that with you, Victor, by chance? Some of this orb activity that seems to be going on, even outside, you know, in and outside. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, again, I really didn't give that much thought, although Andrew Collins says that these orbs are plasma, and they're plasma energy, which again can come from geographic fault areas, or it can come transdimensionally, a form of the energy manifesting as orbs of various sizes and shapes and so on.
Yeah, they love to. They love to be in here with me, and they love to fly in and out of my body, and I've asked them many times to just at least try not to do that. So, and I would bet probably, Victor, you probably have some circulating around you, which reminds me, I think you showed me a couple pictures before the show, and I want to jump into them, and then I want to jump back out on another topic, but I think this is a good spot, since we're talking about energy, to try to describe what we see here. And for the viewers, I'm going to try to insert this picture in just a moment, so just bear with us once we get it here. But so tell us a little bit about this first picture that we're seeing, Victor.
I think I have to preface this by saying that in the late 1990s and early 2000s, I started teaching a class for people to recognize the energy, the human energy field, the aura, for lack of a better word. And what I did was I would teach a class where people could come up and I would project my energy, consciously project my energy out, where they could tell if they were clairvoyant, they could see, clairsentient, they could feel, clairaudient, they could hear, any of the clairs. And at one of these classes in 2000, I was doing this in ambient light. And a friend of mine by the name of Jill Bauman, a wonderful artist and a friend of mine, had a 35 millimeter conventional camera and was snapping some pictures of the event. And on the first picture, this image came up, and it looks like there's this energy field surrounding me, a golden light energy field, basically from my shoulders down to my abdomen, and just this beautiful radiant golden light. A couple of months after she took that picture, and she sent it to me, and I was shocked. I did not expect that. She took Photoshop and used Photoshop to clean it up a little, take some of the glare away. And it showed something else, a focal point of that energy in the center of my chest, almost like there's a being stretched out across my chest with this amazing energy. And I never met any claims behind that other than if it inspired others to do their own research and their own work in the energy field, in the human energy field, then it served its purpose. I wrote an article about it called Light Show. So the first photo that you show, pardon me, shows the energy, the unfiltered. That's exactly what was on the negative. And by the way, you'll see a woman's hand on the lower, I think it's the lower right hand, lower left hand side of the photo. Mm-hmm. And we asked her just to make sure, was she wearing any jewelry or rings on that hand that could have caused a reflection? She was not. Mm-hmm. So what you see is exactly what was there. And this was done in ambient light. The room was not dark. It was an ambient light. Mm-hmm. And so what you see is what you get. And the second picture, as I had mentioned, Jill had filtered it with Photoshop to take out the glare. And that's the image that occurred. So yeah. If it inspires people to do their own research and do their own work and recognize that we are energy, that everything is energy, and that energy neither can be created nor destroyed, but changes from form to form. That's the second law second law of thermodynamics, that yeah. energy can neither be created nor destroyed, but changes from form to form. And so the essence of who we are, this energy, what happens when we transition? What happens to the soul that we call the soul, the energy? Mm-hmm. If it neither created nor destroyed, but changes from form to form, where does it go? And for me, that is the nature of the paranormal.
I have a question on that line. So I interviewed a guest recently, and he was talking a little bit about years ago, he was just in his living room, sitting on a chair on the couch, and this golden, he said it was about the size of a quarter or a 50 cent piece, golden orb just went floating in front of him, probably about a foot or so, floating in front of him. But if you can imagine it just kind of making its way through the room, and just then all of a sudden, you know, gets to a certain point and then it just kind of disappears. And then he said he had moved to another state, which was just miles and miles and miles away. And that one day this golden orb appeared again. And it, like, I think he said it cycled or circled around his body or his leg or something like that. And then it just kind of disappeared again. Have you ever heard of anything regarding golden orbs? That's my question to you.
I think since it's inside, mm-hmm. and it did seem to circle or yep. navigate around this person, mm-hmm. I have a sense. I can't say this for a fact because I don't know the man. I don't know the situation. Mm-hmm. But if I had been with him, I'd be willing to bet that the orb that he saw was a manifestation of the energy of someone he loved who had passed.
Oh, interesting.
A friend or a family member.
I'll have to ask because it followed him all the way. Either it followed him all the way, or I was wondering if he was producing this from his own energy himself, and it was, you know how they say, popping out of your body and all that. But I have never seen, I've seen a cream-colored orb the size of a small clock that you'd put on the wall in my living room that hovered next to a chair about 4 feet high, and then it just dissipated and dissolved right before my eyes after I sat and focused on it. That's the biggest one I have visually seen in my entire life, but I've never ever heard of anything of a golden nature, small or large or anything. Now that picture that we're showing here and have showed, that's amazing with all that golden light around you. And again, one more time for our listeners and viewers, what do you think that is? That your own energy, your own aura? What again do you think that is or attributed to?
I think it might be my energy and a combination of my energy and perhaps one of my guides coming through me at the exact same time. And it's interesting that you talk about these orbs. Are the orbs produced by our bodies?
Yeah.
Science has now shown that the human body does produce photons. Oh. Now, you can't see them with the naked eye.
Yeah.
But they have cameras now that can capture mm-hmm. photons coming out of the human body. Mm-hmm. I think the first one was about 10 or 12 years ago. Yeah. And funny, I wrote a little song, a parody of the song Frère Jacques called Where is Photon? Where is Photon? Here I am. Here I am. Mm-hmm. In your body, quantum. Anytime you want them, shine away. Shine away.
My goodness. Well, you know, the thing is, there's always going to be a controversy on them. But the other thing, too, is that I purchased a book from a gal in Australia who has actually peeled back these orbs. And she has, there's many different images. They're like holograms. I don't know how she does it. She's not sharing her secrets with anybody, but her book is absolutely remarkable. And she does have orbs in there that are, that we would refer to as an alien kind of orb. And then there's also orbs that she's peeled back that are actually spiritual. In other words, just human face type orbs and stuff like that. But I mean, we're talking more significant than when people say, because we like to face matrix all the time. We like to make a face out of just about anything, even dirt in a window. We say, oh my goodness, there's a face looking back at me and it's dirt in the window, or leaves that have formed themselves into something that looks, human-like. That's not what I'm talking about here. This is actual stuff. And, but so minute and so small, and these little orbs are like capsules, and they're on their mission to go wherever, but they go through your houses. They're flitting around outside. I don't know why they have to go inside a person's body, but you know, in and out of a body, but that's very interesting. So my question that I think most are wondering about yet, Victor, is now that you and I have gone to a certain point in life here and we've had some experiences, are you still having experiences now?
I am having intuitive or guide experiences all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I am hearing messages all the time. I had mentioned that story about my being in Korea and my mother being ill and hearing the voice. Well, the voice, which I say sounds like my own voice, but mm-hmm. comes from someplace else. I don't know. You know, Andrew Collins said that it's possible that what we're doing is we're actually hearing that information precognitively from the future, from our future selves, because time, the space-time continuum exists simultaneously. So we're here right now in this moment, but we're also in the future after this is over. So we're driving on a local highway one day with my wife and son. We're in the left-hand lane going at the speed limit, 55 miles an hour, a lot of traffic, but we're all traveling at 55. Mm-hmm. And a voice says, "Get out of this lane now." I immediately listened, pulled into the center lane, and within 5 seconds, there was a multiple car accident to pile up that I would have been in the middle of had I not listened to the voice. Mm-hmm. So when I hear the voice, now there's two types of voices.
Yeah.
There's the ego voice, which shouts at you and, you know, criticizes you. Mm-hmm. There's also the soft voice. It may be firm in terms of what it's sharing, mm-hmm. but it's a softer voice. It's not shouting at you. It's just telling you, for your own good, get out of this lane now. Okay. That's the voice that you listen to. We all have access to that voice, I believe. Mm-hmm. I believe we're all connected to that information and that energy if we choose to listen to it. And listening is the really important thing. One of the things that mm-hmm. has been a major part of my life is back in 1993, for the first time, I read James Redfield's Celestine Prophecy. And for those who are not familiar with it, mm-hmm. it's an adventure story, but wrapped within this adventure story is some very, very basic spiritual truths. And the truth is that in life, people will come to you and offer you some information or something. Mm-hmm. You have three choices every time they offer you that information. You can dismiss it out of hand. Mm-hmm. You can say, you know, that's interesting, but I'll put it away for the future. Or you say, yes, I resonate with that. That's something I'm going to do right now. Mm-hmm. And I've found in my personal life path that every time I've said, yes, that's something I've got to do and pursue that right now, it has made dramatic and wonderful changes in my life. Mm-hmm. It is that approach that got me involved. A very quick story. In the late 1980s, mid-1980s, I was having problems with my back again. Mm-hmm. And a friend of mine said, why don't you take yoga classes? So I started taking yoga classes. Mm-hmm. And the teacher of the class, she and I became very good friends. She said, I love your voice. Would you start leading meditation? I started facilitating meditation. Mm-hmm. We used to go away on these retreats to a Zen monastery in Livingston Manor, New York. And at these retreats, we do yoga and meditation. And at one of these retreats, someone mentioned the word Reiki. I'd never consciously heard that in my life, but something about that resonated with me. Mm-hmm. And there were three of us, and we said, this is October of that year. That's something we'll do next year. 2 weeks later, we were in our first Reiki class together. Mm-hmm. Reiki became the spiritual rocket fuel that launched me into this new path. At that time, my spiritual path was expanding. My ex-wife's was contracting. She and I could not see eye to eye, and my marriage came to an end. At one, I was teaching these Friday night meditation and intuitive classes, and at one of these classes, a friend of mine said, I know this woman who has cancer. She'd like to talk to you about what you do. I met her on a Sunday morning. She opened the door. She said, it's you. I said, it's you. We had never met in this lifetime, but we knew each other. We had traveled together before. That began an amazing healing and loving relationship that lasted for 3 years. And unfortunately, she transitioned at the end. During the course of that relationship, in those days, if you wanted to do laying on of hands, which is part of, you know, Reiki, it can be non-contact or very light contact. You either had to be a licensed massage therapist or or ordained in a faith where laying on of hands was considered to be a sacrament. So consequently, if I wanted to go into a hospital, I couldn't do laying on of hands in my current situation. I was working full time. I couldn't take off 3 years and go to massage school. But this partner of mine, this woman, Judy, said, there's this place called the New Seminary of New York. They train interfaith ministers. You have to go to that. I know this is something for you. I listened. I went. She went with me because the founder, Rabbi Joseph Geldman, who was the founder of the organization, insisted that we enroll together. And the first lesson he taught us, and they had teachers who were priests, Episcopal priests, Catholic priests, rabbis, Hindu gurus, all types of teachers. And he taught a lesson that everything is unfolding in divine order. He said, we may not see it, we may not understand it, but when we open our eyes and follow what we're called to, there is a path in place for us. And that's exactly what I've been living ever since. And I mentioned the resonation with the book by James Redfield, The Celestine Prophecy. In any event, the graduation ordination took place in November of 1997. Judy was getting ill. Her life was coming to an end, but she was on the stage with me. We were at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine in New York, which is an amazing, beautiful cathedral for our ordination and graduation ceremony. I was president of the class. I was giving a speech on behalf of the class, and I was honoring this woman, Judy. She was a special education teacher. She turned the lives of thousands of kids around, and she was so, so loved by so many people. And I was making this speech, and in the audience that day coming in was a student who was coming into the seminary, who was recommended to come and attend the ordination graduation to see what that was like. And she heard me speaking these words, honoring this woman, and it planted a seed. That was November of 97, January of 98, Judy transitioned. She passed away. A few weeks later, I was teaching at the school. I was a volunteer teacher and participant in the school. And this woman kept smiling at me. Every time I turn around, I'd see this woman there. And I'd say, who's this woman? I didn't pay any attention to it. And about a year went by, and we met and started talking. And we fell in love. And 2 years later, we were together and have been together ever since. Amazing lady who is a writer. She's written more than 45 books. She's at 65, she just started going for her master's degree in public history, which is museum work. So, you know, by the way, folks, if you're up there in the age, you know, when you start getting our age, you can, there's no such thing as retirement. If you want something, go for it. This is the time of life to go for it. Anyway, long story short, that relationship ensued. And then later on in the 2000s, one of the things that happened is after 9/11, there was we volunteered for with the Red Cross as chaplains after 9/11 here in New York to counsel families who were waiting for word of their loved ones, and everybody had pictures on the wall waiting for information on their loved ones. And shortly after that, I started attending a meetup here in New York City, the Paranormal NYC meetup. And I met Dom Villela, who was the founder of Paranormal NYC, and he and I became very good friends. He asked me to join his team. I did, and I started going out on my first paranormal investigations back then. And my role evolved into if we actually did find disembodied spirit. And basically, those who are paranormal investigators probably know that you go to like 10 houses out of the 9 out of 10 locations you go, it's either environmental, it might be emotional. There's really no paranormal activity, but the one time there is, that's the time that I was called into work. And my work was to cross spirit over. And basically what I would do is One of the things that used to drive me crazy about the paranormal TV shows is this idea of confronting spirit. Mm-hmm. If there was a physical human being standing in front of you, you wouldn't confront or challenge them to do anything.
Yeah.
You talk to them with compassion and with love. Mm-hmm.
That's right.
But I would talk to these beings and I would visualize them. I would sense them. Mm-hmm. And then I would ask if they're willing to cross over. Mm-hmm. And if they said yes, I would go through this semi-spiritual religious speech, but it was more spirit than religion, mm-hmm. and invite them to turn around and to see their family members who were waiting for them, their loved ones who had predeceased them with their arms open, big smiles on their faces, this beautiful light, and to walk to them and to be with them again. And it was always successful when I did that. So
have you ever run into any situation where energy there was a little bit more reluctant or wanted to put challenge back on you? I just had a demonologist on my show a couple episodes ago, and who does a lot of this type of work of trying to just exercise and or cross over some of these reluctant spirits. Have you ever felt when you go into these situations that someone was not necessarily willing, or they're a little bit on the ugly side that day? What have been some of your experiences?
Ugly side, no. Mm. Demon, no. Mm. Wanting to stay here for a reason, absolutely. And most of the time, mm-hmm. it's they had unfinished business with family, that they didn't want to leave their family, or they had a sense of protectiveness or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
And I respect that. Just the way I would respect if I was talking to a person in a room and they said, I have to stay here. And I said, oh, absolutely. That's your prerogative. That's your choice. That's your free will. Please do so.
Interesting.
Do it with love. Do it with love.
Yeah. Well, there's a number of people, or at least that I know of, that are probably still hanging around for that reason. It's hard. It's hard for some to just, and some are scared. They don't know if they're going up or down, you know? So you talked to me a little bit just before the show about miracle healing. Is that something that you do on the side, or something you do as part of what you do now? Tell us a little bit about miracle healing.
I only really talk about my personal miracle when I was in Korea, the mm-hmm. healing from hepatitis B. That's the only personal miracle that I really experienced. But mm-hmm. I don't practice miracle healing, but I am a Reiki master, and I've given Reiki to others. Mm-hmm. And what I've come to learn, especially about all forms of energy healing, is that whatever you do, it always has to be done for the highest good of the person mm-hmm. who's being the recipient. And the reason being is we can't tell what their soul plan, what their life plan might be.
Yeah.
And if that plan is to leave this world and go on to the next or whatever it might be, that is their life plan. That's not mm-hmm. anything you or I could interfere with. But to comfort them and give them healing energy, absolutely. But I do not have a miracle healing practice now.
Okay. Speaking of writing, I think you do a little bit of poetry here, right? So
yes,
would you mind sharing with us a few of your poems and giving us a little bit of explanation that goes along with them?
Absolutely. I have two in particular that I'd like to share with
our
viewers. One of them came, I'd mentioned earlier about this being wired as a youth.
Yeah.
That if you take care, if you make other people happy, if you're a people pleaser, take care of others, you will be loved. Mm-hmm. And a lot of my life was spent with that on my shoulders. And a couple of years ago, I had a situation where I finally said no. Mm-hmm. It was the hardest thing I ever had to do.
Mm-hmm.
But I wrote a poem about that called The Healing Power of No. And I'd like to share that with you now.
Sure.
A time comes for choosing rather than losing the essence that makes us so.
Mm-hmm.
And in the bestowing, there's power in knowing the freedom that comes with no.
Mm.
When said with compassion, not angry in fashion, and letting the self-love flow,
mm-hmm.
there's a sense of renewing and deep soul imbuing the awareness that comes with no.
Mm-hmm.
So with gentle voice, and the power of choice, and the freedom to make it so. I'm still here, my friends. There is no means in this end,
mm-hmm.
just the healing that comes with no.
That was great.
Thank you.
That's great. Now, I can't remember. Did you say you're publishing your book of poems? I can't remember.
I'm in the process of compiling each mm-hmm. of these poems and mm-hmm. putting a little, as you explained, a little mm-hmm. bit of what the poem was about, what inspired it for me. Mm-hmm. And I'm putting them together in a book, and hopefully by the end of this year, it'll be published.
Oh, great. Well, let me know, because I want to buy a book. So
thank you. Thank you very much.
And what is your second poem?
The other poem came about because so many of us have lost loved ones, especially over the last 2 years with COVID. Yeah. And in general, there's just been a lot of souls leaving this world, and a lot of tragedy and a lot of mourning and a lot of grief. And I came to realize that we see someone's transition as an end. And because of my personal experience, I know that there is no end, just a new beginning.
Yeah.
And I wrote a poem called Circles and Rings, and I'll share that with you now. Mm-hmm. The path of great beauty in so many things, from atoms to galaxies, circles and rings. Natural wisdom that dwells there within, from naught to 360, that magical spin. Mm-hmm. We circle each other in gravity's dance, as Gaia circles soul, the solar romance, as Luna circles us in life-giving motion, drawing the tides and inner emotion. And the age of the oak is found in its rings, as in woman and man and all living things. Mm-hmm. And when the rings stop and life comes to an end, we'll all circle back and dance once again.
Wow, my goodness. That's powerful. Have you always been a natural poet, or where do you feel that this is a gift you've had all your life? Or do you think this just started to take hold of you and you just recognized it?
I think the first poem I wrote was when I was like 7 or 8 years old. I think mm-hmm. it's something. Another thing that's interesting that Andrew Collins shared when I interviewed him is that a lot of people who have had these experiences, and also the psychic experiences, often become artists, poets, writers. So absolutely.
Yeah, I'm all of those too. I mean, but that didn't awaken in me per se. Until I was done. I have 5 advanced degrees, and I was so busy getting degrees that I didn't really have time for myself. And then now that I have time for myself, I realize that there's some unfinished business that has taken place. So wonderful stuff there, Victor. Victor, tell everybody how they can either get a hold of you, or any books that you have out or are coming out, any events, anything of the such. I will get this in the show notes at the end of the show. And if anyone needs to contact Victor, again, respect his time, but please, by all means, reach out. So Victor, how can people get in front of you?
Well, a couple of things. Number one, my podcasts are on Om Times Radio, Wednesday night at 8.03 p.m. Eastern. There's one called Destination Unlimited, which is the crossroads of science and spirituality. Okay. In fact, that's where I interviewed Andrew Collins. On Thursday nights, I have a show called Vox Novus, also 8.03 p.m. Eastern on Om Times Radio. Okay. And that show is about the necessities that people are experiencing since the advent of COVID and all the changes that have been happening in our world. Advice for people to make changes in their lives and to find fulfillment in their lives in these very, very perilous and changing times that we're experiencing right now. My website is victorthevoice.com. It's a little bit in need of repair. I haven't had a lot of time, but I have to update it. But some of my poetry, some of my writings are there, and some of the information is there. And I will be developing that. And I have one book that I co-authored with my wife, Lori Sue Brockway. It's mm-hmm. called Pet Prayers and Blessings, about bringing the spirituality to your pets. Funny story. Someone asked my wife if she marries dogs, and she said, no, I don't do marriages for dogs. And they said, Reverend Lori Sue Brockway, who marries dogs, wrote this. So, you got to be careful what you say to the press.
Oh,
sometimes.
My. Yeah.
And then so that book. And then later this year, Poems is going to be coming out, my book of poems. Mm-hmm. And about 10 years ago, a friend of mine in business, I also spent 42 years in industrial business and engineering. Mm-hmm. And a friend of mine said, how do you balance the fact that you have this day job in industrial business and the spiritual work you do, the night job?
Yeah.
And very naturally, I said, The day job pays my salary.
Yeah.
I said, the other work pays my soldiery. And my second book will be called Soldiery, The Compensation of Spirit.
Wonderful. Wonderful. And I need to clarify one thing here, just in case. Are you found on YouTube at all?
I do have a YouTube site. Mm-hmm. I have a few guided meditations up there, a couple of things. Again, not really active,
yeah.
But the best thing to do is my podcasts are archived on YouTube.
Okay.
Under Om Times Media. If you go to Om Times Media,
yeah,
and look for Destination Unlimited or, yeah, Vox Novus, all my podcasts are archived there.
Yeah. And that's, you know, with in our day and age, it seems like everybody knows YouTube. And I wanted to make sure that people get to you in one way or the other. So, but I'll get all this in the show notes. And again, thank you again very much for being on the show.
Kelly, my gratitude. Thank you for having me. It's so unusual for me to be on this side of the microphone. And it's nice to be able to share my story. So thank you.
No, it's great. And we'll talk to you again. Thank you.